Maybe seated. Good morning. My name is Ruth. I'm one of the pastors here, and I want to welcome you to week two of our series, When Everything Seems Broken. I think we have a graphic for that. I don't know what that phrase communicates to you, when everything seems broken. I hope that you think, no, actually, there's lots in my life right now that's really good and beautiful and positive and happy. I hope a lot of us feel that way. But I have to confess that I've been feeling this quite a bit recently. I wouldn't say everything's broken, but you only have to listen to the news for just a little while to realize there is a lot right now that seems broken in our world. And that sense of brokenness is perhaps not all out there in the big wide world. We might feel it in here too. We might feel that we're feeling a little bit broken right now. And yet, as Kevin mentioned, we aspire to be a community of hope and transformation. So how can we have hope? How can we communicate hope to others in an authentic way when, let's say, almost everything seems broken? And that, of course, is what this series is all about. How do we embody good news in a time like this that can seem pretty dark? How do we do that in a genuine way without getting all weirdly religious? Because although the word gospel means good news, people who go to church, people who follow Jesus, are not always considered to be good news. I don't know if you've noticed that. My family was up, and we were up in New York a couple of weeks ago, and we had to take a metro train. And I was feeling a little bit uneasy. It wasn't at all crowded, and actually just about everyone had a mask on. But I was feeling, you know, a little not great about it until this guy came on our carriage and started to tell us how we were all going to hell. Mainly, it seemed, because of various sexual sins that he felt the need to describe in some detail, much to the amusement and, I think, embarrassment of my teenage kids. I didn't take a poll, but I would say from the body language and from certain choice comments, people didn't feel any better for that guy talking to them that day. You know, I don't think anyone went home and thought, I am so glad that guy was on my train this evening. He was not good news. Now, I don't think many of us go around telling people they're going to hell, least of all perfect strangers on a train. I'm certainly hoping not going into the kind of details he was. But it hit me really hard in that moment that religious people, people who go to church, people who claim to follow Jesus, feel the need to preach at people a lot. You know, generally, we think it's our job to tell people how to live, regardless of whether they want to listen. Author and minister Adam McHugh describes the church this way. We consider ourselves experts on topics without anything more to learn. We tell God what to give rather than asking. We participate by speaking and sharing, and we assert our identities by taking verbal stands. We shout our messages from the rooftops without knowing who is listening and what they need. We view others as projects rather than people with unique stories to be heard. We consider our great Christian task to be preaching rather than assuming the listening posture of a servant. I think there's a lot of truth in that. And yet, if we look at Scripture, we see that although we are called to speak and to speak out, we are also called and called first to listen. If we think back to the story of creation in the book of Genesis, there is a cosmos there that is in total chaos. The poetry of Genesis doesn't talk about God starting with nothing and just producing the universe as we know it. It says that God took the chaotic something that was nothing and transformed it, gave it order, gave it shape. Water, and particularly the sea, was an ancient metaphor for chaos. And we read in Genesis 1, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, 'Let there be light,' and there was light." So the whole of the created order begins by listening to the voice of God, listening to the Word, as we read in John 1, the Word that brings life. And listening in the Hebrew language, shema, is the same word as to obey. To listen is to hear and to respond. And we see this pattern continue throughout scripture. God speaks to Adam and Eve, and they listen. And they decide not to listen with some very negative consequences. God calls Abraham out of the land of Haran, and he listens and follows. God gives the law to Moses, and Moses listens. And he teaches the people to pray these words morning and night. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Hear, Shema, listen. Discipleship, too, is a call to listen, to hear, and to follow, to put our listening into practice. The natural order, then, is to hear first and then respond. But so often, in so much of life, we want to speak first. We don't really want to listen. Psychologist David Benner contends that most people are actually pretty rubbish at listening. And in fact, we're so bad at listening that we don't listen when people tell us that we're not listening. He writes, most people think they already are good listeners. They may have learned to be reasonably attentive when others speak and assume that that is all that is involved. However, what they are often listening to is their own thoughts about what they are hearing. Looking at it from the other end, I'm sure we've all been in those conversations when we know the person we're speaking to is not really listening, right? We're saying one thing, but we can hear that they're actually hearing something else. They're filtering what we're saying through their own perspective. They assume we think and feel the same as they do. Our experience of something is the same as their experience. Or we can see they've formed a judgment, and actually, although they look like they're listening, they're really just waiting for their in to tell us how we should be. I think we've all been in those kind of conversations, and I think if we're honest, we probably know that we do the same to other people. People in general are not good at listening. We find it hard to make the voices in our head quiet enough to really hear, to really listen to what someone else is saying without making judgments and assumptions. Conversations, places where we should be really able to connect with another person, can often end up feeling like competitions. We're competing for airtime, we're scoring points, we're winning arguments, but we're never really being heard. And there's great loneliness in that. Most of us long, maybe all of us long, to be heard, to be understood, to be really known and accepted and valued. But because so many of us feel that way, we're all talking at once, longing to be heard, and nobody's listening. Imagine for a moment if that guy on the New York train, instead of preaching to everyone, had come on and just turned to the exhausted-looking person next to him and asked empathetically, long day? I don't know these people. I don't know if that would have sparked a conversation or not, but I do know it would have been a very different atmosphere on the train. Listening well is a gift to other people. It's an act of service. There's power in speaking, but listening is giving up control. Listening is putting to be heard to one side for a moment to make room for someone else. It's a form of emptying ourselves. In the Greek, that's known as kenosis, and that's what we read Jesus did in Philippians 2. Jesus emptied himself, taking the form of a servant. The word of God, as John's gospel refers to him, became silent. For 9 months, he was in his mother's womb, unable to speak. Listening, we know babies listen, but unable to speak. For the first couple of years, like any infant, he would have babbled. He would have had to listen and imitate and learn. We read in Luke's gospel, Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. Jesus grew in wisdom. He wasn't born fully developed, all wise, fully, you know, reasoning as an adult. He was a baby, and then he was a little kid, and then he was a young man, listening and learning. We're going to look this morning at a story from early in Jesus's public ministry, where maybe we see some of that listening and learning going on. It's the story of the Syrophoenician woman, a foreigner, who comes to ask Jesus to heal her daughter. But before we read that story in Mark chapter 7, Let's look at the context from that gospel account. The story also appears in Matthew's gospel, but we're mainly going to focus on Mark's account. So in the first few chapters of Mark, if you could put the map up, we have Jesus in the first few chapters has spent almost all his time here. He does take one quick trip across the Sea of Galilee to Gergesa, but most of his time is spent in this area of Galilee that we looked at actually in the last series between Capernaum and Nazareth, his hometown. And during this time, as you might also remember from our last series, Jesus encountered a woman who had been hemorrhaging. She'd been bleeding for 12 years, a woman who was considered unclean because of her condition and who was absolutely desperate. And so she broke with Jewish purity laws as well as with social conventions, and she touched Jesus' clothes, which was quite a shocking thing to do. And she was healed. And in that same story, Jesus went to Jairus' home, the synagogue leader's home, and brought his young daughter, who had died, back to life. So another unclean female for whom Jesus was the only hope. That's Mark chapter 5. Then in Mark chapter 6, Jesus feeds 5,000 men plus women and children with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. That's a very famous story, probably all very familiar with that one. After which Jesus says, "I am the bread of life. I am the bread of heaven." And then at the beginning of chapter 7, Jesus gets into a conflict with the Jewish authorities over what it means to be clean, what it means to be acceptable and pure and acceptable to God. The chapter begins with this words. "The Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus and saw some of his disciples eating food with hands that were unclean, that is, unwashed. The Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding on to the tradition of the elders. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash, and they observe many other traditions, such as the washing of cups, pitchers, and kettles. So the Pharisees and teachers of the law asked Jesus, 'Why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders instead of eating their food with unclean hands?'" Now you might be thinking, the Pharisees are right. You really should wash your hands before you eat, especially if you're coming in from the market. Who knows what kind of germs are out there. But of course, the writer of Mark's gospel explains to his readers, who actually probably were Gentiles, they weren't Jewish, so they would have needed a bit more explanation. This is not about basic hygiene, which they didn't really know about at that time anyway, but this is not about that. This is about Jewish ceremonial washing. Again, you might remember from the last series, we saw how the temple rituals about that concerned ceremonial cleaning. So the ceremonial bathing that was to do with the temple that happened in these 7-step baths and the use of stone vessels that could be washed. I think we have a picture of the cups that we saw that were found in Galilee. These stone ones, they could be washed and they could be made ceremonially clean, which earthenware pots couldn't. These rituals that were originally associated with the temple in Jerusalem seem to have been imposed on the general population by the priests who moved into Galilee around the first century BCE. And here in this story, it seems that we've got the religious leaders from Jerusalem coming up into Galilee to police, as it were, the adoption of these rituals. Now, this confrontation with the religious leaders gets very heated. Jesus responds with these words, "Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you hypocrites. As it is written, 'These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are merely human rules. You have let go of the commands of God and are holding on to human traditions.'" And Jesus goes on to offer examples of how they disregard God's commands and focus instead on these rituals and practices that they love so much. Now, this was not a polite, kind of abstract theological debate. This was Jesus caught up in a direct and impassioned confrontation with powerful men. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law spoke for God. That was the basis of their authority. And Jesus challenges that authority head on, saying, actually, they don't speak for God, not at all. They ignore God and instead speak for their own interests. That can't have gone down very well. Mark doesn't describe how the authorities react, but I think we can guess. And in fact, of course, we know the end of the story. We know that they decide to kill him. So Jesus has this very heated confrontation. And then according to Mark's gospel, he gathers the crowd around him and explains that it's what's on the inside of a person that makes them clean or unclean, not what they eat or how they wash. Now that might sound pretty innocuous to us, but the thing is, a lot of the stories of the most beloved martyrs at that time were stories of Jews who were tortured and killed for refusing to eat unclean food. Usually it was pork. So is Jesus really saying here that these martyrs, these national heroes, died in vain, that that wasn't what counted? Don't these rituals actually represent what it is to be Jewish, what it is to be God's chosen people, to be acceptable to God? Again, Mark doesn't tell us how the crowds respond, but it's probably unlikely to have been a popular sentiment that Jesus was expressing here. It challenges the Jewish people's very sense of identity. So Jesus leaves the crowds and goes into a house, and his disciples come to him and say, "We don't get it." And Jesus' response is rather blunt. He responds to them, "Are you so dull?" I like the Message version of this. It's even more to the point. "Are you being willfully stupid?" Ouch, that hurts. I'm sure that hurt the disciples, actually, to be rebuked, obviously rebuked. But you also get the impression that Jesus is hurting. This matters. This is important stuff. This is about what it means to be in a right relationship with God, what it means to be God's people, to live in God's kingdom. This is what Jesus is all about. And the religious authorities are totally opposed to what Jesus has got to say. The writing really is already on the wall with them. And the crowds are probably struggling with it, but at least he's got his disciples, right, to take this message into the whole country. They get it. No, they don't get it either. I wonder just how lonely Jesus must have felt at that moment. How frustrated, how afraid even, not just afraid for his disciples' physical safety and his own, having confronted so obviously the very powerful religious authorities, but possibly even afraid that this mission is going to fail because nobody seems to get it. And so Jesus leaves Galilee, a Jewish region. Let's show the map again. So he leaves this part, this Jewish area, and goes up here around Tyre. So this is in Gentile, non-Jewish territory in the north. It was historically had been quite hostile territory, but it's the Roman province of Syria, which today is in Lebanon, not in Syria. It's a little confusing, but he goes up there and possibly out of fear, as we said, for physical safety, but also would get the impression that he's going there just to get away from it all, to get away from the opposition, to get away from the constant demands of the crowds that gather everywhere he goes. He needs some time and space to be alone, to pray, to think, to rest. Last week, we talked about the balance between the outward and the inward, how Jesus taught and healed crowds, but also withdrew. And here we see that, we see him withdrawing. This is the context for the story we're going to look at this morning in Mark chapter 7. So let's read that story. Jesus left that place and went to the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know it, yet he could not keep his presence secret. In fact, as soon as she heard about it, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an impure spirit came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek born in Syrian Phoenicia. She begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. "First, let the children eat all they want," he told her, "for it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." "Lord," she replied, "even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Then he told her, "For such a reply, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." So she went home and found her child lying on the bed and the demon gone. This is a difficult passage. It's actually a very controversial passage. Lots and lots of blogs out there about this passage. Because Jesus seems to be quite rude to this desperate woman who comes to him for help. He calls her a dog. So let's break it down a little bit and see what's going on here. First, we're told that this woman is a Greek born in Syrian Phoenicia. That phrasing suggests that she's of a Phoenician ethnicity and has the status of a citizen. So therefore, she's probably relatively well-to-do. And she has a little daughter with an unclean spirit. I'm sure that wouldn't be the modern diagnosis. I don't know what was wrong with her daughter. Maybe she had epilepsy or some kind of a mental health issue, or, you know, who knows? We don't know at all. But in that time, whatever was wrong with her daughter, in that culture of the day, she was considered unclean. An unclean daughter of an unclean woman, given that she's a Gentile, desperate for Jesus' help. Does that sound familiar? We've got echoes here of Mark chapter 5 and the hemorrhaging woman and the daughter. We see that kind of reflected here. We'll see in a little while why that's relevant. So this woman probably has social standing, but she doesn't act like she does because, as we said, she's desperate. In Matthew's gospel, we get a few additional details that aren't in Mark. Initially, this woman stands a short distance away and shouts to Jesus to try and get his attention. We read, she says, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is demon-possessed and suffering terribly." Jesus did not answer a word. So his disciples came to him and urged him, "Send her away, for she keeps crying out after us." He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel." So this woman yells at Jesus from across the way. She doesn't care about decorum. She needs help, and she knows Jesus can help her. In fact, she uses the words that a beggar typically would cry, "Have mercy on me." And Jesus ignores her. He doesn't say a word. And the disciples, well, they're just annoyed with her. They just want to get rid of her. So she goes into the house, crossing conventional lines, and throws herself at Jesus' feet. This woman of status humbles herself before this young, itinerant Jewish rabbi. And Jesus responds with these words, "Want, for it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." Chances are this would have been familiar language to the woman. The Jews often refer to themselves as the children and Gentiles as dogs, particularly Greeks who kept pet dogs, which Jews did not. Now, Jesus softens the language a little. He uses the diminutive form, so in effect he calls her a puppy dog. But still, this is an insult. He's calling her a dog, which makes this text rather problematic. So how are we to understand this? Well, there are many interpretations, and some of them I don't think are very helpful. For example, some commentators say, well, to Jesus, next to Jesus, we're all dogs, we're all wretched worms, and none of us has the right to Jesus and say exactly what life. But in the Gospels, we don't see Jesus just saying exactly what he likes. Although Jesus calls out religious hypocrites, he's generally portrayed as being very kind, very compassionate, particularly with marginalized people, such as women, and particularly with people who are hurting and who are in need of help. So I think we can disregard that interpretation. I don't think it's helpful. Other commentators say Jesus is racist and bigoted and rude, and this woman had to stand up to him. That's actually quite a popular interpretation right now. I was kind of surprised. But I have to say, for me, that does not ring true at all. We don't see that anywhere else in Scripture. And even according to Mark's gospel, this is not the first Gentile that Jesus has healed. And here he is in Gentile territory. He voluntarily went into Gentile territory. He doesn't avoid Gentiles, which actually stands in stark contrast to observant Jews of his time. So personally, I don't hold with that view either. But there are various other interpretations that I think are possible and are helpful and that are not mutually exclusive. I think there's truth in all of them. So we're going to look at three of those today. The first is the suggestion that Jesus is teaching his disciples a lesson by letting this woman demonstrate the faith that she has in a way that would be shocking and therefore memorable for the disciples. The disciples have been urging Jesus to send her away. She's nobody to them. She's a heathen foreign woman, and she's just annoying, actually. Just get rid of her. And Jesus uses proverbial language of the time, with which I think that the disciples would have fully agreed. Jesus has declared himself to be the bread of heaven, the bread of life, and he says that the bread is for the children, for the Jews. It's not for the dogs. Isn't that right, guys? I'm sure, I can imagine them all. Yes, that's right, Jesus, get rid of her. In this interpretation, Jesus sees this woman as a person of real faith. She's called him Lord, Son of David. She recognizes who he is and his power to heal. And so Jesus cues her up to demonstrate faith and to refute the disciples' prejudices, which she does. She demonstrates what Jesus refers to as great faith. And because of her response, her daughter is healed. The Jewish religious authorities had rejected Jesus. They were the ones who were meant to speak for God. They were the ones who knew God's will, and they reject Jesus outright. The Jewish crowds, the people who were following him, they didn't get it. Even his disciples, they were dull or perhaps willingly stupid. Here she is, an outsider. She's foreign, she's Gentile, she's a woman, and she gets it. This woman sees that Jesus is not interested in religious purity. He's not limited by ethnic divides. He doesn't have that exclusivity. He's bringing life and healing to anyone who will receive it. And so she takes Jesus' language of children and dogs and says, even the puppy dogs get the scraps. And Jesus agrees with her, much, I'm sure, to the disciples' surprise. A second interpretation looks at this exchange through the lens of honor and shame, which, of course, were and still are to some extent very important cultural considerations in that part of the world. The woman, a citizen, possibly pretty well-to-do, has surrendered her honor out of love for her little daughter. She's come out unaccompanied into a public space, which respectable women would not do. She shouted across the way to Jesus, a male stranger, using words typically used by beggars. And then she's thrown herself at Jesus' feet. In this culture, she has behaved shamefully. But Jesus doesn't withdraw from her all horrified. He doesn't send her away dismissively. Rather, he engages her in a debate, thereby treating her as an equal and helping to restore her honor, which, of course, would have been very shocking for a Jewish male to do, to treat a foreign woman, a supposedly despised foreign woman, as an equal. This again has got similarities with the story a couple of chapters ago about the woman who bled for 12 years, who was unclean, who dishonorably crossed social barriers by coming into a public space and touching Jesus' clothes. There too, he spoke with the woman. He listened to the woman and praised her faith, elevating her from someone who was shameful to someone who actually was honorable and was a model of faith for other people. But in this story, Jesus goes even further and engages the woman in what Professor David De Silva terms a social game of challenge and riposte. He writes this. The challenge riposte is essentially an attempt to gain honor at someone else's expense by publicly posing a challenge that cannot be answered. When a challenge has been posed, the challenged must make some sort of response, and it falls to the bystanders to decide whether or not the challenged person successfully defended his honor. The Gospels are full of these exchanges, mainly posed by Pharisees, Sadducees, or other religious officials at Jesus, who are upstart, threatening to steal their place in the esteem of the people. So in this interpretation, Jesus graciously offers the woman an opportunity to respond to a challenge, to best him, as it were, publicly, and therefore regain her honor. And we see that in this conversation. When the woman responds, Jesus doesn't explain further or argue in any way. He readily succeeds that she's won. He says, because of your answer, basically you've won. You get what you asked for. Your daughter is healed. And a third and final interpretation that we're going to look at, and again, I don't think these are mutually exclusive. I think there's truth in all of them. The third explanation is that Jesus listens and learns. In Matthew's account, when the disciples asked Jesus to send the woman away, he says, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. Similarly, a few chapters earlier in Matthew chapter 10, Jesus sends out his disciples saying, do not go among the Gentiles or enter any town of the Samaritans. Go rather to the lost sheep of Israel. Although Mark's gospel doesn't have that phrase about going only to the lost sheep of Israel, as we saw in Mark's gospel, up to this point, Jesus has almost exclusively stayed in Galilee, around his home region, a very strongly Jewish area. And that's not really surprising. Jewish people believed that God would send a Messiah to restore Israel. And then in due course, after Israel's been reestablished and is flourishing, then Israel would draw other nations to Mount Zion, to the temple, to God. So there are theological reasons why we would expect Jesus to say he's called to the lost sheep of Israel, not to the surrounding nations. There are also practical reasons. Remember, Jesus is only in Tyre because he's had to escape both the vehement opposition of the authorities and the seemingly never-ending demands of the crowds that gather everywhere he goes in Galilee. If he extends his teaching and his healing to the surrounding areas, it's likely he's going to multiply both the opposition and the crowds. So responding to this woman is potentially costly for Jesus. Things are already getting pretty intense. Does he really want Roman authorities after him too? And yet, contrary to cultural expectations, Jesus engages with this woman. He challenges her and listens to her response. He listens. He doesn't just hear the words she said, but he really hears her desperate need, hears her faith in Jesus's ability to save her daughter, hears her wisdom and insight. She doesn't argue that the children shouldn't be fed first, but what Jesus brings is so important, so abundant, so life-giving that others need it too. The puppy dogs will wolf down the scraps. Whatever you've got to give, we'll take it, she seems to be saying. We too need the bread of life. At least give us the crumbs. And Jesus apparently changes his mind and credits her for changing it. Because of your reply, Jesus says, the demon has left your daughter. And from here in Mark's gospel, Jesus goes on to heal and perform miracles, other miracles in Gentile territory, as he has in territory. So we get in Mark's gospel this pattern. So chapter 5, he heals a desperate, unclean Jewish woman and an unclean daughter. Chapter 6, feeds 5,000 men in Jewish territory with loaves and fish. Chapter 7 has this conflict over who is clean, who is acceptable to God. Also in chapter 7, heals a desperate Gentile woman's unclean daughter. Chapter 8, feeds 4,000 people, 4,000 men plus women and children, with bread and fish, this time in Gentile territory. So the message, I think, is very clear for Mark's mainly Gentile readers. Jesus is addressing issues of the heart. It's not about ethnic boundaries. It's not about religion and religious rituals that make you clean and acceptable. Jesus is about bringing spiritual food, bread that heals and restores. And although that began with the Jews, it's now spread to include the Gentiles. I want to be clear. I don't think the writer of Mark's gospel is. We do know that Jesus learned. After all, as we've said, he was born a baby. He was fully human, and part of being human is learning, having to learn. Not only did he have to learn to talk and walk and read, he had to learn how to view the world. He was taught the Jewish scriptures. He would have been taught that Israel was God's chosen nation, that they were special and Gentiles were not. He would have been taught that men were superior to women. He would have been taught that children were relatively important, that people who were disabled or sick were cursed by God, and so on and so forth. Did he know instantly that those things were not true? Or was it when he met Gentiles and lepers and sinners that he saw them for who they were, people made in God's image, equally loved and special? We don't know. We really don't. The Gospels don't tell us very, very little about Jesus' development as a child and as a young man. What did Jesus know when is a question we really don't have an answer for. But it seems from some passages that Jesus has a growing awareness of who he is and what his mission is all about. From events such as his baptism and the account of temptations in the wilderness and the transfiguration, these stories suggest a growing awareness for Jesus of what it meant for him to be the Messiah, rather than Jesus having it all perfectly laid out for him at the outset. And we know from other scriptures that there were at least some times when Jesus changed his mind, in addition to the one we've just read. At the wedding in Cana, we looked at a few weeks ago, about a month ago, Jesus's mother asked Jesus to do something about the fact that all the wine had run out. And initially he resists. He's saying, my hour has not yet come. But then, of course, we know he goes on and does intervene and turns about 150 gallons of water into fine wine. Similarly, in John chapter 7, Jesus tells his brothers that he's not going up to the festival in Jerusalem. I don't think he's lying here, but he certainly changes his mind because then a little bit later he goes on up. And Jesus says in John chapter 5 that he only does what he sees the Father doing. Like an obedient Jewish son, he's an apprentice to his Father. He watches his Father and imitates him. He learns from him. And here in the story of this Syrophoenician woman, I think we see Jesus not only listening to the woman and hearing her need and her faith, but also listening to the Father. Although the work began with the Jews, it seems actually it is now time to go into the surrounding Gentile areas. They are ready for his message, or at least some of them are, as evidenced by this woman. Jesus says repeatedly in the Gospels, those who have ears to hear, let them hear. I think we often read that and think of it kind of as a bit of a rebuke. You know, you've got ears, why aren't you listening? Kind of thing. But perhaps, actually, this is an invitation to listen and to be open and curious. Perhaps Jesus wants to share with us an attitude of openness that he has grown to embody and to really value. Jesus engaged with this foreign woman who was behaving shamefully. Despite his own exhaustion and all the cultural barriers in place, Jesus values her, offers her a challenge, and then listens to her response. He's willing to be changed by what she has to say. And maybe he even learns more about the Father's way of working through listening to her. The writer of Matthew's gospel records that when the woman approached Jesus and yelled repeatedly at him to have mercy, Jesus didn't say a word. The writer doesn't provide an explanation, so we don't really know, you know, what was going on there. But it seems reasonable, perhaps, to guess, given the context, that Jesus, being fully human, was simply exhausted. And perhaps he was also frustrated that he's been found when he was trying to stay hidden and when he really, really needed to stay hidden and to get some rest. Perhaps that's why he needed the extra prompting of his disciples wanting to send her away before he roused himself enough to respond. So what can we learn from all of this? What does it teach us about listening to ourselves and others, which is the title of the message today? Well, first, I think we need to listen to ourselves. We may be exhausted and need to rest and recenter. We talked last week about the need to balance the outward and the inward. Jesus took time to get away, to go somewhere where he felt safe, where he hoped to be alone, to rest and think and pray. If Jesus needed that, surely we do too. I think it's easy just to keep going, stay busy, and not pay attention to how we're feeling and why. How we're doing. This is when using things like the welcoming prayer can be really good to help us think through where are we at and how are we doing? What's going on with us? As Kevin mentioned, we do have discussion questions. They're out on the table on the welcome desk in the Commons. They're also posted online, so do check those out. That might help you to process a little bit as you reflect and try and recenter. If you want an opportunity to do some of that inner work in a small group, we have two emotional support groups that will begin on Tuesday at 7 o'clock. One's online and one's here in person. They're gonna be led by Amy and Roger, who are professional counselors. So do check those out. There's more information in the flyers and on the website. Do sign up for those if you'd like to come to those. So we need to listen to ourselves. Second, if we are feeling tired and anxious, then the chances are we will not be as sensitive to these as we would usually be. So we might need to listen extra hard at this time. We might need to make an extra effort to stay open to people, to be extra gracious to those around us. Third, listening is a gift to others. It's an act of service and love. Listening elevates the speaker. It honors them. Listening, really listening to another person rather than to the voices in our head, is a loving thing to do. Author and theologian David Augsburger wrote, "Being heard is so close to being loved that for the average person, they are almost indistinguishable." Can we listen like Jesus, even when we're tired? Can we be open to different views, different experiences, different perspectives to our own? Can we listen in order to learn and change rather than to judge or fix the other person? That kind of listening takes practice. We have to train our minds to be quiet enough that we can really hear. I'm not great with acronyms. I tend to forget what they stand for. But one I do like is WAIT, W-A-I-T. Why am I talking? It's a good one to keep in mind when you're trying to listen to someone and you suddenly realize, actually, I'm doing most of the talking here. As the saying goes, good listening starts with the scandalous premise that this conversation is not about you. And finally, not only are we encouraged to listen to ourselves and to others, but God invites us into God's ongoing eternal conversation. God listens because God is love, and that's what love does. Love listens. Scripture describes Jesus as listening to the Father, and the Father listening to Jesus, and the Spirit revealing only what she hears. God is in constant conversation, and we are invited to step into that conversation. In Galatians 4, we read, "Because you are children, God has sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father." The Spirit of God within us calls back out to God. How cool is that? Pretty amazing. So let's be open to listening to God's voice through all of life, through nature, which Scripture says declares the glory of God, through the circumstances of life, through other people, through silence and solitude. Let's listen for the voice of God in each part of our day. We're going to take communion in just a moment. And often we talk a lot about what communion means and different ways that we can interpret it and understand it. But today we're actually just going to try and quiet the chatter in our heads and simply receive, simply open ourselves up to God. Just as we literally take the cracker and the juice, we're figuratively taking in the Spirit of Jesus. So let's just pause and be quiet for a moment, simply resting in God's presence, allowing God to speak to us, but not trying to force anything. Let's just be still.